Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Jody Dean.
and Jody, it's wonderful to see you. Unlike me, it looks as though you have a real backdrop. My backdrop is from a photograph I took, but yours is bookcases with tchotchkes and books.
Lots of books, and the primary reason is I found it too complicated to figure out how to set my background. So,
You've got a real background. Why not?
yeah.
So, Prof. J, my first question is to ask you what's currently dynamizing, retarding, preoccupying, exciting, interesting you?
The genocide in Gaza. That's all I think about. That's not quite accurate. I also, because it's the 100th anniversary of Lenin's death, I've had to do a number of things related to Lenin. But so it's a combination of Gaza and Lenin that has absorbed me over the last few, particularly the last few months in Gaza since October 8th.
Could we speak about Lenin first and then Gaza? Tell me
Sure.
about how you see his legacy, which has gone through so many different interpretative turns over that century.
I'll describe this in terms of a presentation I just did for this series called Leninist Days, and it's put together by a Cuban translator. His name is Rolando, and now I can't remember his last name, but Rolando has brought together Leninist political people and academics from all over the world to do seminars on Zoom on Saturdays and Thursdays. And I've done several of these now. And my primary one was on Lenin and desire, or Lenin and the question of desire as a way to approach the woman question. And the angle I took was actually that of a fangirl. And so my approach to Lenin is really as a fan. Of course, I can approach him as an academic and as an organizer, and those are significant. But as a way to counter the wrongness of counter-revolution and anti-Leninism that's particularly strong in the U.S. because, in some ways, it's like the Cold War never ended. I approached Lenin with respect to what are the great things that he did, what is the greatness of his legacy, what do we learn from him, what's wonderful. And I also really love his wife Nadezhda Krupskaya's reminiscences of Lenin, for the way it gives a insight into the early years of forming the party, early years of Bolshevism, the period in exile, but also Lenin as, oh, they get a puppy, Lenin holding a kitten, they're going for hikes, Lenin being enthusiastic about one thing or another from different times of his life. So my approach to Lenin is very much a fan, a supporter, someone who really believes that there's so much that we can continue to learn. And that so much that he can continue to inspire in us.
I guess his reputation initially did well from the horrors of Stalinism and then took a blow from a revisionist position that laid much of Stalinism at his door. Yeah. And now there's an ongoing debate, I guess, about those things. This is apart from, as you say, his theoretical contributions and so on.
Yeah, and so I think the political angle on Lenin has to be, 100% in favor of. And that because there's no such thing as a neutral reassessment. And I don't think it's good to give ground or make any concessions to the critics, because I don't think the critics usually are coming in from the standpoint of, oh, what we really want is communism and to increase the forces of the revolution. Usually it's something, it's like, well, they go too far. We need to be more cautious. It's never, or so rarely, a critique that's raised with revolution as the horizon that, Yeah, like I don't believe in giving ground on that. Let me give another example. I have written a few pieces with a co-author, Kai Herron, who's really wonderful. He's based in the UK under the general topic or topos of climate Leninism, and it's a kind of learning from, but also a challenge to Green New Deal approaches and any kind of eco-politics that is not attending to the political organizing that's part of it, and particularly the issues around imperialism and anti-imperialism that have to be central to any climate politics. So that's another part where, again, we're drawing from Lenin, and we also draw from a Leninist trajectory that we don't trace through Europe, but through the anti-colonial struggles, because so many of them were explicitly Marxist-Leninists.
And in terms of climate Leninism, I wonder if you could elaborate a bit on that for us.
So the basic idea is that we can think about Lenin as giving us an emphasis on the role of the party, on the irreducibly political aspect of struggles, and the revolution is the horizon, and the centrality of anti-imperialism. And so with those kind of key markers, we approach climate politics. So, for example, particularly the Extinction Rebellion movement, weirdly, or movement for slit, maybe we could call it. One of their positions has been climate change isn't a political struggle. It's not about politics. That's just inane. Of course, it's a political struggle. It's a class struggle, and it's a struggle against the imperialist forces. So that's part of it. It's to recognize, first of all, that it's definitely a politics. Another part is to say that it's not a politics that's going to be resolved with localism, right? Like, it's like you can have all of the nice, light bulbs and organic vegan food in the West Coast of the US, and that's not going to change the global outlook, right? It's a global problem that's going to require global solutions. And if the left doesn't approach it that way, and explicitly from a anti-imperialist standpoint, what we're going to do is affirm a kind of climate apartheid, where our solutions are only focused on maintaining a particular way of life in the global north, while letting the climate devastation be really borne by particularly people in the global south.
And come back to some of those issues a bit later, if we may,
Yeah.
but I wonder if we could return to Gaza, the first
Yeah.
item that you mentioned, and your analysis of that.
I'll approach that from the climate part. One of the unbelievably I don't know what devastating, shocking, it's hard to find the words anymore for the genocide that's been going on. But one of the things I think it tells us is that the imperialist countries like the United States, like Germany, like England are willing not just to tolerate the genocide of a people, but they're willing to participate in it. So it can unfold in real time, the utter devastation of a people, and it's not just like, oh no, it's more like, oh, here are more weapons. We will veto, like particularly the US, we will veto everything that's will every international mechanism of international law that's in place to prevent things from happening. I think that this is a precursor of what we can expect as the heating of the planet increases and global uprisings increase. It's like any kind of international legal order has been proven to be utterly bankrupt. And the capacity of the country, or the willingness of the countries that like to present themselves as the moral center of the world, is what many people, particularly in the global south, have known for centuries, they're really willing to do everything they can to secure their position. So it's like I think that we will continue to see like it, Israel and the US gets away with all of this, really gets away with the utter genocide of a people. There's no safe place in the world. There's no legal order. There's no balance. This is the kind of war of all against all that's going to continue to unfold. I don't think it can be taken seriously enough. So I sometimes feel like, oh, that's a terrible thing to say, Jody, because what you're doing is acting as if, or speaking or thinking as if, the genocide of the Palestinians alone is not a catastrophe. And I do think it is alone a catastrophe, regardless of any extra, any other repercussions, like, war in the Middle East or, these horrors I'm talking about. So I think these two things at the same time, that the attack, the genocide of the Palestinians, which has been going on, of course, since since the Nakba, since, what is it, 47, 49. But the open allowance of the utter destruction of a people is really, I don't know. I think many people are in the same position of like doom scrolling this all the time, being at actions, organizing actions multiple times a week. I feel a little inarticulate about it, after, what is it, over 5 months of this.
Sure. And just yesterday I chatted with Lisa Hajar about this, and she was very eloquent. And I've also spoken with people who are part of all kinds of protest movements against it. I think in New York alone there are five or six Jews for Peace groups that are opposed to what Israel is doing. The question becomes, in part, as you say, not only the hypocrisy of these imperial powers that are involved, but also something that you've addressed a lot in your work, which is the effect that social movements of different kinds do and don't have. So I wonder if we might walk onto that terrain for a bit. Thinking of the new social movements, as they were called in the 1980s, as being principally feminism and environmentalism, but also gay liberation and other related topics. But of course, the really new social movements being the quasi-fascist right and its street mobilization of the politics of spectacle, emulating progressive examples.
All right, I think my response is going to be a little scattered, so we'll go back and forth, I assume. First thing, one of the things that is the I don't know, upside, inspiring part, the something that's accompanying the horror is the largest global movement in solidarity with Palestine that we've seen in over 40 years. And that's been really, really exciting. I feel like it's like a reinvigoration of the movements from the 70s and 80s. People might have called them, sort of third worldism, or the kind of third, the but the solidarity of Western slash global North with third world liberation struggles, we see unfolding again in a really exciting and wonderful way. Particularly, I think, in countries like the US and the UK that have been so much in lockstep with Israel, to see the global outpour, to see the outpouring of protests that are also like moving to levels of real civil disobedience as well. So not just sort of marching around. This is quite important. And I think it's important for the long array of struggles that will continue, have to, will necessarily continue with the heating climate and the unbearable economic inequality. So the right now we are seeing these struggles in an exciting way. So that's the first point. So, but at the same time, it's not like they've stopped the genocide, right? Like, and this becomes deeply, I think, for many of us, the keeping of the kind of revolutionary optimism of building the movements and holding the protest and calling people to come out at the same time that the death rate rises becomes quite frustrating. It's like, are we making a difference? Now, I do think we're making a difference because the consciousness is changing. But then I'm like, Jody, tell that to the people under the rubble, right? Like, how much is that consciousness changing happening? You know, how much of a difference is it making? So it's like you have to hold, I feel like you have to hold on to two things at the exact same time, right? A kind of, you know, the revolutionary optimism. And I don't want to say, you know, optimism of the will in, what is it? Pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will. I don't want to say that so much because I think both of these are about the intellect and the will and the heart. So the first, so on that score, I think that the movements are mattering in a really significant way, but clearly not enough. And that holding on to, we have to keep doing them, even when it doesn't seem like the change that we want is happening, is the kind of is part of that struggle. How do we make it endure? The right is, yeah, like organ. It's super. It's interesting. Like, yeah, I mean, we see there's the right, and they're strong, and they're in. They've got political office, right? Particularly if we think of, you know, and they've had real effects. You know, Bolsonaro, Trump, Brexit, Netanyahu. You know, then stuff in Hungary, what do you call it? Poland. At the same time, I mean, it's, I actually don't feel like the right wing in intensity is there right now. It seems like it was stronger 4 or 5 years ago, and that the left resurgence is where the energy is right now. So, and that seems to me to be a good thing and a positive thing, obviously, right? But I don't, like, I'm not so convinced that right now that the right is the kind of threat that it was. And I think it's in part like this, you know, the cycles are going on so that the reaction to, say, the gender politics and the anti-reproductive justice politics and all of that, and kind of fascist vibe, that the reaction against that on the left is now more intense than the right is. So, but I think, you know, it's a back and forth. So I just think that that part of the battle, at least at the street level, is on our side, even as the military battle, right? Like at the state level, the forces of imperialism, they've got the weapons.
At a party political level in democracy, some of this is also about the utter failure of social democracy to give working people what it keeps promising them, and abject failure to represent them in any significant way. Hence, the appeal of things like anti-immigrant, anti-woman rhetoric, and promised legislation, and hence the turn to those on the right who argue for what in many cases appear to be pro-working class positions, which they will never adopt should they come into power, but nevertheless help to impel their capacity to win people away from social democracy, because it has been such and continues to be such a disgrace. Here in Spain, for example, in Britain, as you mentioned, and it's barely worth talking about the Democratic Party as a representative of social democracy, whatever that may mean nowadays. In the United States. On the topic of these social movements, I wanted to ask you a campus question because it's been a big issue on campuses across the US that a number of people have spoken to me about. About a quarter of our listeners are in the United States, the rest are all over the world. Could you give a little bit of context for this in terms of, say, your own school? What it is, the kinds of students that are there, and what the experience for you has been like as a political theorist, feminist, leftist, and activist on this as on several other issues.
With respect to Gaza, right?
But with respect to Gaza, yes.
Yeah.
But acknowledging that
So,
you have this position at this school, you've been there many years, you're known for the sorts of things that I just mentioned,
yeah.
inter alia.
So I'll speak a little bit about that, and then also brought out. So I brought it out. So I teach at a small liberal arts college, and our situation has not been one with a great deal of anything, right? In fact, was very soon after the Al-Aqsa flood operation, our administration came in with a super therapeutic orientation toward the entire student body, which the first statements were terrible. It was just a statement about the civilians killed on October 7th, and then finally they recognized that there are Palestinians who've been enduring a siege and occupation for decades, and so they finally acknowledged that Palestinians were humans. But then whenever there was an event, it was like, we will make sure to have counselors available to talk to people. So the initial unfolding on our campus was very much the whose lives are grievable, mourning, and we have to respect all grief, that kind of really depoliticization. And because we're a small college, the number of students, basically, I think we have maybe two Palestinian students, and a handful, probably under 30, Muslim students. And they, because of their isolation on the campus, they didn't want there to be a lot of activity. It's just like, it's hard enough. We didn't want that. So, but I live close to, I live in the Finger Lakes of New York, and there are a lot of colleges and universities in the area. So I'm kind of equidistant between University of Rochester and Cornell University, both which have been sites of lots and lots of protest and lots of administrative policing and discounting and just a straight up repression of students and faculty, and really resilient student groups trying to fight back, push back, whether or not it's via. I mean, on both campuses, there's been a lot of demonstrations, students facing disciplinary actions because of this, along with the conceit that what's the most important thing is to make sure that Jewish students feel safe, right? And I just spoke at University of Rochester under the heading of "Who Can Be Defended?" And it was a plea that we need to kind of openly defend Hamas. And I was speaking with a student group, and the number of the students in the room emphasized, like, we're Jewish students. We are in favor of, we oppose Israeli genocide. We are in favor of, into the ceasefire. I don't know if they went so far as to go into the occupation, but they emphasize, like, clearly in the United States, we are the center of discussion. Our place on college campuses is the center of discussion. And I was, even though I kind of knew that implicitly, I also found it really kind of shocking and awful. Honestly, to be really honest, like, it's like, no, it should not be the case that the fears of undergraduates in these safe spaces is the center of a discussion rather than a genocide being carried out every day, clearly, since October 7th. And I would say also, arguably, since the, I mean, we can go into the dates, but let's say since the Nakba, this has been it's integral to Zionism to take the whole space and to eliminate the Palestinians. So that the center of the conversation in the United States has been able to be figured as the emotional security and feelings of safety of a group of undergraduates on the most privileged campuses in the world is kind of appalling.
And those who don't fit that category are self-hating Jews. So yet again, the discourse of interiority is mobilized again and again and again, therefore, as you say, depoliticizing these questions and rendering them all about people's emotions, which are important, of course, but emotions come from somewhere and are treated in certain ways and justify certain things. So it is interesting also that these universities, where we have seen the right rabbit on for a long time about the idea of cancel culture and free speech, are now quite keen on cancelling things and not so keen on free speech when it doesn't
Straight
suit.
up. Oh, sorry. Yeah, you're. I'm sorry. Like, totally right. I mean, to the point of lawsuits, right? So that different universities have had lawsuits brought to them, where the, brought against them for violating the. I think it's Title IX, but I might get the titles wrong. But let's say Title IX guarantees of non-discrimination against students by not pr installing sufficient protections that secure their Jewish students is the claim from hate speech. And so then the claim is slogans like, from the river to the sea is hate speech, it's genocidal, or calls for like the slogan, long live the Intifada, or like up here it's like from New York to Gaza, Intifada, Intifada. That those are off limits. And that in that the fail the university's failure to eliminate them utterly from the campus is a violation of the civil rights of Jewish students. And of course, large percentages of the Jewish students totally reject that and are completely on the side of the protesters. And so then it really is doubly weaponized. Like you said, it turns them into like creates a contradiction and split within them as well. So.
And this Title IX to which the prof refers is Title IX of the Federal Education Act, which was implemented in the mid-60s and basically was meant to ensure that universities that got federal money, education being a state's right in the US, not a federal one, would nevertheless have to comply with certain federal laws, including this one, which is about equal opportunity and protection. And it's become important, for example, in the redistribution of funds towards women's as well as men's sports on campuses. It's had all sorts of beneficial aspects, but as you say, it is now being used as, I think the term du jour is lawfare, right?
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of it here in Spain. So, Prof, I wonder if we could move on to something else now, and it's to a term that perhaps you coined, certainly are well known for. And I'm sure you'll tell me if you invented it. Communicative capitalism. And this gets to one of your other themes, which is about the media, but specifically new technology media.
Yeah, so my partner claims that he coined it. We were in a discussion. I think I coined it, but it kind of doesn't matter. It came out of the discussion and I theorized it. And I was looking for if he, I just remember we were newly together and on a panel on Hartman Negri's Empire in Budapest. And I'm like pushing like, oh, I want to do this critique. I need a better name. And he may have said community of capitalism, but I think I should get the credit because I developed the idea. So, or it's both of us and it's a nice collective thing. So by communicative capitalism, I mean the way that that capitalism and communication have merged so that our communicative activities as speakers and hearers becomes useful for capitalism and then takes on capitalist dynamics on the one side, and then how capitalism relies on speech and language and communication for its own ability to generate profits and expand. So there are ways that we can make this like sort of super industrial and machiny and talk about the way that factories have moved to using more and more sort of information technology and AI. But that's using communicative apparatuses, infrastructures. That could be one, but it could also be things like we could also talk about social media or the mass use of private communication devices like cell phones. So there's a whole range, and I think the wideness of it is why thinking in terms of communicative capitalism is useful and names part of our present. I mean, I thought of this as a an alternative to the language of cognitive capitalism that came, that was so strongly developed from the Italians. And I think, and the difference is that the cognitive part really emphasizes the contributions of tech workers, and not the use of masses in the technology. And so that I think it's the communicative, the exchange, the creation of like the way that capital can seize the social substance of our interactions because they're online is quite remarkable. And so that it's the relational, the communicative, the social bit that cognitive capitalism leaves out and that communicative capitalism can designate.
And is this something that you date from a particular moment and locate in a particular place?
I love that question. I don't. So the answer is no, but also that's a little bit of a dishonest answer because the answer is no because I didn't strictly periodize it to say, oh, it rises up here at this point, and to see more of. Kinds of, so I was more interested in seeing the kind of rise of information technology and how it affects, communicative patterns. But there's a book, what's his name? Armand, so it's like Information in the World. It's a very thin little book. I can't remember the name, but he talks about the Reagan administration's use of Armand Madelard. Is that the guy's name?
Armand Masselard, yeah, Belgian sociologist.
Yeah, that's a really good book. And it would be on the one, like I would think of that as like pre-communicative capitalism, but showing us how it would be getting there. So we could, so, but if I had to periodize, I would say with the 1996 Telecommunications Act and the now privatization of the internet rather than it being held by public structures. And that, so it's not a hard and fast, but it's an easy way to start thinking about it. Yeah, and then on the one hand, for sure, it seems very US, but it was already, even at that point, a global telecommunications network, but global elites, like whether or not it's being used by sort of academics and scientists and bankers. It wasn't a mass, a mass technology, but it wasn't strictly speaking a US technology.
Yes, and certainly in France and in the European Union, as it became, informatics was the cry for the age from the late 70s. And of
Yeah.
course, Lyotard's postmodern report on knowledge from the late 70s for Canadian provincial government was very much driven by these developments. Prof, the next thing I wanted to ask you about is the C word, communism. You've already mentioned the big man and the centenary of his passing. And is that a bust of the big man I can see behind you, behind sort of your left ear, or is that someone
Yep.
else?
No,
Yeah.
that's Lenin.
So, okay, VI is there. Lots of people are prepared to jump up and down now and say, I'm in favor of socialism in a way that I didn't see so much 30 years ago in the US. Not so many people jumping up and down and saying, I'm a communist. Discuss.
Let's first talk about the socialism question. In the US, Bernie Sanders was just enormously significant for the 2016 election and normalizing the language of socialism so that it wasn't on the fringe anymore. And that's so that plus the economic situation so that the majority of people don't feel like a kind of standard middle class life is in reach anymore. That combination of material reality and someone saying it has made socialism normal again. Then we can say that then there's also like a an infrastructure. Maybe we could like a social media and media and publication infrastructure, like around Jacobin, and then a zillion podcasts where people really talk about socialism. So socialism there is an acceptable part of the left in the U.S. In a way that it wasn't, I don't know, before 2008. Now, on the communism front, it's still the case that I'm like Obama said something directly like anti-communist in one of his in multiple speeches. Like he'll throw out, communism, terrorism, just like any other mainstream leader. So someone that people on the left thought was going to be a good guy was happily anti-communist. And it's the case that some of the people in the socialist milieu are straight up anti-communist, and that, but. In a way, it's like they still feel the need to say something about communism rather than just to ignore it as if it was in the dustbins of history or something. So, weirdly, at a time when there's no Soviet Union, socialists still feel like they also have to worry about communism. So, I think that's good for communists in that people still think that we matter and that we have, that we're somebody to oppose. So, the right uniformly always wants to attack us. And then they have these, the Black Book of Communism and these different victims and memorials, victims of communism and memorials to the victims of communism and all this kind of stuff. So they really want to head off any kind of communist discussion. But that keeps communism in the mix as something important. And I think as more and more people on the left, and now I'm really just talking about the US, but maybe Canada somewhat, as they realize that socialism had essentially the European version of sort of Euro socialism was not a success. It gave up too much. It made too many concessions to capitalism. And that we have to, and also I could say it made too many concessions to forms of nationalism, like being insufficiently internationalist and anti-imperialist. I think communism is going to have that our vision and popularity is only going to increase.
And one of the other non-isms that you write and speak about very eloquently is democracy. Can you share with us how democracy and communism have intersected and might intersect?
No, this is such a hard one because this is the kind of question that always gets me into trouble. And it gets me into trouble in part because I don't think that democracy names a political horizon. I think that democracy is the language of, yeah, I feel like democracy is a language of complacency and acquiescence and acceptance of the status quo. And the reason for that is that the United States describes everything it does as democracy. Freaking elections are democracy. Invading Iraq, that's democracy. Helping Israel, that's democracy. Everything that we talk about is called democracy. And so I don't think that the language has a critical edge that we need against capitalism and imperialism. The US still holds on to an ideology that capitalism and democracy are compatible with each other. But the lived experience of millions of people is no, they're not compatible with each other. But can you then use the language of democracy to criticize capitalism, to say it's insufficiently democratic if the capitalists themselves are describing what they're doing in democratic terms? I mean, Lenin and State and Revolution distinguishes between bourgeois and proletarian democracy, and that's the most accurate way to do it. However, not that many people in the present are really comfortable with the language of bourgeois and proletarian. It seems sort of dated. It doesn't respond to where they are. And so at that point, I'm willing to throw out the language of democracy in order to keep the center on the critique of capitalism with communism as a horizon.
Prof, I've got two more questions for you. And then what I'd like to do is throw it to you to add anything to what we've discussed. Does that sound all right?
Yeah, but can I then ask you questions? I'm actually really interested about the politics of Spain right now.
I'll do my best. So
Okay.
the first one is the last ism I'll mention, feminism.
Okay.
If I go back to think about the received wisdom of so-called second wave feminism in the US, it came from, in part, a number of quite angry communist women who'd felt exploited by husbands and other men in their lives and felt as though the idea of the proletarian as the agent of the future relied on a male and industrial model that excluded them. I think that's at least one of the history that can be told. So, where feminism today in the context of a communist spirit?
That's a great question. Some of the most exciting stuff going on, I think, in left theory is around the politics of the family, family abolition, and social reproduction. So those are some of the most fruitful and sort of forward-looking and generative areas. And do we want to call that feminism, or do we want to call it socialist feminism? Do we want to call it, proletarian feminism? I'm not really worried about on this one. I'm not super worried about the name, but I think that the headings of family abolition and social reproduction theory are useful. So on the family abolition thing, there's some different versions for the most part, even though they call for family, and I think Sophie Lewis is probably the most hardcore. Like, I really mean abolition of the family. I think some of the other people in that discussion, like Emmy O'Brien or oh, now I'm just really terrible with names today, but some of the other people would go with more like what they really want is an expand, like Shrinchek and Hester. They've got a book on post-work and the family in post-work. That's really interesting. I think it just came out this year or last year. But the expanded circuits of care beyond the nuclear family is a really interesting set of kind of feminist concerns. And that's important. And it seems to me to be correct of where the left needs to focus a lot of energies, in part because so many people are service sector workers now. And so the largest set, so both as a labor within the home and also the increasing part of the size of the wage labor force means that these concerns are overlapping in a really great way, like social reproductive work, whether or not it's waged or unwaged in the home or informally waged, right, as it is, in huge parts of the world. So that's an exciting area of Marxist feminist, socialist feminist work. Then, so that's the kind of social reproduction family abolition part. Then there's the war against the right on questions of gender, abortion, trans rights. That's a super important struggle because the right uses those issues to expand. But in terms of thinking, like not just fighting a defensive battle, but fighting an offensive, expansive one, I think some of the family things go really far.
Indeed. And my last question, Prof, before throwing to you, is to ask you how you find shit out.
How I find shit out? What do you mean?
How you do your research.
Honestly, I buy books like water, like glasses of water. Like I'm just like, if I see something or I hear a mention or I see something, I'll just go buy the book immediately. So I buy a lot of books and I read a lot of books at the same time, right? So I may not read them in the most disciplined way, but I read a lot of books. Also I see what my circles are talking about on Twitter and on Facebook. That leads me to talk about and also this one's maybe more interesting than these generic answers. Whenever I travel, I always ask whoever I'm around, what are you reading? What are the graduate students reading? What are people talking about? What's important? And one of the things that has been interesting to me, like over the last 10, 15 years, maybe not 15, but roughly 10 years in political theory, people aren't using names very much. Like, so if we said, like, 20 years ago, people would say, oh, I'm reading Badiou, I'm reading Zizek, I'm reading Agamben, reading Rancière. These names would come up. These days, it seems like it's much less driven by great thinkers and individuals, particularly individual men, and much more driven by issues and concerns, let's say questions of Afro-pessimism and race, or I call it gyno-pessimism, but they might say misogyny. But it's the thematics that are, and the issues, climate, race, capitalism, end of neoliberalism. I'm using the heading neo-feudalism, but it's more the themes that are coming out that people are talking about and not great figures.
It's a really interesting observation, really true. We had a very interesting podcast on Afro-pessimism recently. So, Prof, are there things that you'd like to add, which could include questions?
I'm going to be speaking at a conference on Lenin in
Bilbao.
Bilbao in April. And one of the things I'm wondering about is what's the kind of general vibe on the Spanish left right now? Isn't there a socialist government at this point? And are people happy
Yes.
with it? What's the deal?
So it is in power. It is called the Socialist Party, Socialist Workers' Party of Spain, but it is essentially like the Democrats. And its base is in two groups, not unlike the Democrats, older working class people and a liberal middle class. There was an insurgent leftist group that emerged from the Indignados Podemos that you've undoubtedly heard of, but it was pretty much wiped out at the elections last summer. And the more insurgent or supposedly insurgent part that is connected to communism is SUMAR, SUMAR, which is part of the government in coalition with the socialists. So when we say the socialists in Spain, we mean the Democrats or the Labour Party in the UK. Nothing more radical than that, right? SUMAR, which came from nowhere to do very well, won about 30 seats, 30 deputies, is run by somebody whose father was a prominent communist and who sees herself as a communist, Yolanda Diaz, who has worked very hard for workers' rights. Recently, Sumar did very poorly in provincial elections in Galicia, in the north of the country, which is where she's from, and people are now concerned that it may itself fall away. But the key thing to realize here is that just as the Civil War never ended in the United States, it never ended here, and there are still people alive, Jody, who were tortured by the fascists. Were enslaved by the fascists. There are still people alive who've never been able to uncover the remains of grandparents and great-grandparents slaughtered and enslaved by the fascists. And there are still lots of people who love the dictatorship, including wealthy young people. So you can go to different Spanish cities and see something that really will remind you of the Cold War, painted on walls, which will say death to Reds. I live on a street which is a thoroughfare for major demonstrations. There were demonstrations involving hundreds of thousands of people after the election because the socialists managed to stay in power by cutting a deal with right-wing Catalans. Catalan nationalism is divided between right, center, left. It's not the romantic world that the Anglo left likes to imagine. And these demonstrations, I would see people and listen to them as they walked by my apartment and in the street with me, were Louis Vuitton 21-year-olds, basically. Wealthy young people from the far right. And this correlates with a certain amount of evangelical influence that comes in part from Latin America, but also with a very deep Catholicism and the work of Opus Dei, the secret society. So the left is constantly having to negotiate those things. On the gender score, one of the really interesting elements is that attempts to secure rights for trans people and abortion rights for women and safe use of the street for women, which is pretty good in Spain compared to the United States, have been met with a form of hysteria by the right. And so those issues are big ones, as is the question of immigration. Because as a member of the European Union and as a signatory to Schengen, there is relatively free movement of people within the European Union here. At the same time, as of course, this is a post-colonial state, it had 500 years of occupation by North African Muslims. But that is regarded by the right as a triumphant moment of Christian salvation, rather than being seen as part of a post-colonial heritage prior to their own history as colonizers. Whereas for the left, there is a certain embrace of this. So I would say there is a vibrant, sorry for the long-winded answer,
No, it's a great answer. Yeah.
there is a very vibrant leftist politics, and I'm proud that my friends are part of it. And just as in the Civil War, there are people who regard themselves as anarchists, there are eco-socialists, there are eco-feminists, the full spectrum of perspectives, and that this has a vibrant life and world, but it is matched by a similarly vibrant and people like you and me, much scarier and violent tendency on the right. In a couple of
That's
hours,
beautiful.
I'm actually recording a podcast with some of the leading eco-feminists in Spain who are activists for things like bicycle lanes. And that's one of the key issues where I think the left has made really important inroads in public policy matters that, yes, touch on capital P politics and can divide people, but yes, provide benefits that go beyond the middle class, but include the middle class. If at Bilbao
Super
they
interesting.
question you, just blame some British American guy that you know who was sitting in his enclosed terrace in Madrid telling you what to think.
At least it gives me a better orientation than I had before. So very useful, and I appreciate that.
Not at all. Listen, it's been great to chat with you. I'm very excited about your speech in Bilbao and your contributions to, I guess, what we would have to call rethinking Lenin. Because he has gone through so many iterations in the imaginaries of people around the world. I feel as though I've learned a lot from talking to you today, and I really appreciate it.
Oh, it was very fun. Thanks for the conversation. And I hope I see you again.
That'd be great.